Today is Friday, June 19th, also known as Juneteenth in the United States. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court gives a victory to immigrants brought to America as children.
This is really all about the Dreamers, and it's about the rule of law. Dreamers who have proven themselves worthy of being called Americans and getting to call this home.
As the U.S. movement against racial injustice grows, today marks the day all enslaved African Americans learned they were free 155 years ago. Also ahead, an American singer is donating all profits from his new album to groups fighting racial injustice. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States Supreme Court has handed President Trump a second stunning election season rebuke in just the last few days, this time in a bid to end legal protection for young immigrants. Trump has argued immigrants are taking jobs away from Americans. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the story.
The administration tried to end DACA, the Obama-era program that shields from deportation 650,000 immigrants brought here illegally as kids. The court ruled 5-4 in rejecting the administration's argument that the program is illegal, with Chief Justice John Roberts joining the court's liberals. It made top Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer cry.
These kids, their families, I feel for them.
Kids like Alejandra Gonzalez in Wisconsin.
I can continue living as a normal human being.
The court ruled Monday employers cannot fire people for being gay or transgender. The president tweets both rulings are politically charged, like shotgun blasts to the faces of Republicans and conservatives. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Joining us to talk more about this is California Attorney General Javier Becerra. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. What is your reaction to the court's ruling?
I think they have restored not just the Dreamers, but Americans' faith in our system of justice. This is really all about the Dreamers, and it's about the rule of law. Dreamers who have proven themselves worthy of being called Americans and getting to call this home, and the rule of law, which we all used to take for granted until this administration tried to do things by breaking it all the time. And so it's a good victory, not just for the Dreamers, but for everyone who believes that if you do things the right way, there's a place for you in America.
What was interesting, though, in the opinion, it sort of seemed like they were saying, you know, it's not for us to decide whether this is right or wrong, but based it on the argument or the lack of an argument against.
That's correct. And the justices said the right thing. It's not for them to judge whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's not for them to judge if it's a good thing that President Obama created DACA. And it's not for them to judge whether it was a bad thing that President Trump tried to eliminate the program. Their job is to make sure that if it's done or undone, it's done the right way. And what this court found was that the Trump administration tried to undo DACA the wrong way. They didn't follow the rules, in this case, the Administrative Procedures Act, and they acted arbitrarily and capriciously.
Does this finally take away the uncertainty for Dreamers, or will they need to continue to live in fear about their future given the president is likely to try some other way to reverse their rights?
It's a yes and no answer. Yes, it takes away the uncertainty about the Trump administration's efforts to eliminate the DACA program in 2017. That effort is now snuffed out by this court, but it doesn't stop the Trump administration from making an attempt in the future. And so, no, this doesn't take away the uncertainty, because at the end of the day, this is an executive order by President Obama that a president can undo if it's undone the right way. Donald Trump tried to undo it the wrong way. And so there is still uncertainty. The only way to gain certainty, the only way to have finality, the only way for Dreamers to know that America permanently is their home is to have Congress act. And so far, the House of Representatives under Speaker Nancy Pelosi have passed a bill that is supported by the overwhelming majority of Americans bipartisanly, Democrats and Republicans. This seems it's no longer really a political or a partisan issue. And the only obstacle at this stage is the Senate Majority Leader and the Senate Republicans, who are unwilling to bring that House bill that passed out of the House to a vote on the floor. And so Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, should be pressured to let that bill have a vote up or down. But Let it have a vote. Why hold it hostage when the Supreme Court has spoken and most Americans throughout the country have said, let's get this done.
Tell us why what happens to Dreamers matters for the nation as a whole.
Dreamers are our neighbors. They're our friends. They are the frontline workers we see during this COVID-19 crisis. I think there are some estimates that some 27 to 29,000 Dreamers are in the health professions as doctors, nurses, frontline first responders dealing with COVID-19. Dreamers are graduating from college. They are making the country better. The country would lose billions of dollars in taxes and I think tens of billions of dollars in economic capacity and development if we were to lose the Dreamers. And so in so many ways, they've proven that they are American. And I think our values and our system of justice dictate that we do what's right. And here, I think the Supreme Court echoed that. And now is the time for us to settle this because there's very little dispute. Most Americans agree. Give Dreamers a chance. You got to prove yourself. You got to show that you've earned it, but give them a chance.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra. President Donald Trump is scheduled to hold his first big, large indoor campaign rally since much of the U.S. banned large gatherings in early March due to the coronavirus. He will be on the campaign trail in Tulsa, Oklahoma tomorrow, June 20th. The rally was originally scheduled to take place today, June 19th, but was changed by one day after widespread criticism. June 19th, 1865 is known as Juneteenth and Freedom Day. It marks the end of slavery in the United States, despite the Emancipation Proclamation being issued more than 2 years before that. The news had just not reached all enslaved black people. Also controversial, Tulsa is the site of the single worst incident of racial violence in the United States when in 1921, known as the Tulsa Race Massacre, mobs of white residents attacked and killed black residents and businesses. Republicans say President Trump didn't know about the significance of African Americans on June 19th or what happened in the city of Tulsa. As global protests continue to demand action over years of inequality and systemic racism. International Edition Steve Miller spoke with Dr. Scott Ellsworth, a professor in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. They spoke via Skype about the two events that have sparked further controversy.
The Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921 was the single largest incident of racial violence in American history. It happened during a very perilous time for African Americans, an era of lynching, of the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan, which was the largest terrorist organization in American history. But there were some events that happened in Tulsa. There was an incident in an elevator between an African American male teenager and a white American elevator operator. We don't know what happened actually in the elevator, but the next day, one of Tulsa's afternoon newspapers, the Tulsa Tribune, published an inflammatory article saying it was an interracial rape attempt. And they also published an editorial entitled "To Lynch Negro Tonight." And within a half an hour of that paper coming out, a lynch mob started to gather downtown at the Tulsa courthouse. The mob grew over the hours, 200, 300, 500, 1,000. Then around 10:30 at night, a group of African-American World War I veterans, all armed, went down to the courthouse, presented themselves to the sheriff, said, "We're here to help defend the prisoner." They were turned away, but as they went, an elderly white man tried to disarm one of the black vets. A shot was fired, and the race massacre began.
Now, as I understand it, ultimately, the National Guard was called in around the 1st of June to kind of put things to rest. Is that correct?
That's correct. The state troops, the National Guard troops from Oklahoma City, were called in, but there were local units of the National Guard who were involved early. But by the time the state troops had arrived, Tulsa's black community, known as Greenwood, had already been largely destroyed. A mob of whites, we don't know how big, maybe 5,000, invaded the black neighborhoods, looting and burning more than 1,000 homes and businesses to the ground.
In a statement to VOA, The Oklahoma National Guard called the events in 1921 nothing short of horrific. And while there are widely varying accounts of the role played by the National Guard during the rioting, the truth of the matter is that many of Tulsa's white citizens committed atrocious acts against their neighbors and guardsmen. However, the historical record shows that a handful of brave guardsmen protected the Tulsa Armory and the weapons inside from more than 300 white rioters. The actions of these guardsmen substantially reduced the number of murders in the Greenwood District. And in the days following the riots, Oklahoma guardsmen restored the order to the area and prevented further attacks by both black and white Tulsans. So that was 1921. This is 2020. It's 99 years after the race riot in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 150 plus years after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. And this is coming at a time where we have worldwide protests addressing inequality and systemic racism. So I guess the question I have for you, and it's a very difficult one, why are we still having these kinds of conversations, you know, so many years after the fact?
Well, I think one reason is, I mean, there's a couple reasons. One reason is that much of our history has been suppressed. There are certain versions of American history that school children learn, and oftentimes some of the more darker spots are wiped away and people don't know about them. So that's been a process. The White Race Massacre was actively suppressed for decades. It's been a long process to get that story out. The other is that, you know, American society is far from perfect, but there's been a lot of change. Certainly been great changes in my lifetime. So as people start to learn more and get a more accurate and fuller picture of our nation's past, I think people are starting to question what it is that we as a nation should do today.
So is education the primary way to address this?
I think it's a very important way to address it, but I also think we have a larger problem, which is America is a nation that is obsessed by race. Americans think about race when they leave their, when they go out the front door, what neighborhood they're going to, when they walk into a room, and we talk about it, but the problem is it's we tend to talk about it only with people who look like us. And we are still a segregated society by school districts, by churches, by neighborhoods. What we need to do is to start having honest face-to-face conversations about race with people who don't look like us, to be able to listen, to understand their perspective, not to be accusatory. And I think once we have a better idea as to where we've been and where we're at, we'll have a better plan for where we should go in the future.
International Edition's Steve Miller speaking with Dr. Scott Ellsworth, a professor in the Department of Afro-American and African Studies at the University of Michigan. The number of deaths per day from the coronavirus in the U.S. has fallen in recent weeks to the lowest since late March, even as states reopen for business. But scientists say they're worried the trend may be about to reverse itself. New Zealand's COVID-19 border controls will be tightened after two women who had been allowed to leave mandatory quarantine early on compassionate grounds tested positive for the disease. It's a setback for New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who said June 8th there were no active cases of the new coronavirus in the country. Phil Mercer has more from Sydney.
10 days ago, Jacinda Ardern said her South Pacific country of 5 million people had managed to crush the virus through some of the strictest lockdown measures in the world. Now New Zealand's Prime Minister is apologising for a bungle involving two women who'd flown home from Britain to visit a dying parent. The New Zealanders were mistakenly released from mandatory quarantine without being tested for COVID-19. All returning citizens must go into state-managed isolation for 2 weeks and be tested twice for the new coronavirus, once on day 3 and again on day 12. The women later tested positive for the disease. Screening of more than 300 people who'd come into contact with the pair is continuing. They travelled from Britain via Doha, Qatar, and on to Brisbane, Australia, and then flew to New Zealand. Officials say it's unclear where they were infected. Ardern says it was an inexcusable error.
This case represents an unacceptable failure of the system. It should never have happened, and it cannot be repeated. From the beginning, we have taken an extraordinarily cautious approach at the border. That is why we have required every returning New Zealander to go into a facility that we manage. Our borders and the controls at our borders must be rigorous. They must be disciplined.
The New Zealand military has been put in charge of quarantine facilities. Early release of those in isolation on compassionate grounds has been suspended. Opposition politicians have alleged that the handling of the quarantine system seemed incredibly loose, with reports of people in isolation at hotels mingling in bars. There have been calls for New Zealand's Health Minister David Clark to be dismissed. The two cases bring to an end 24 days of no reported COVID-19 infections in New Zealand. The government has scrapped almost all of the disease control measures, although its international borders remain closed to foreign nationals. New Zealand has recorded just over 1,500 confirmed and probable COVID-19 infections. 22 people have died. Health officials are warning against complacency, insisting there was a pandemic raging outside our shores. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has wrapped up 2 days of meetings at Honolulu's Hickam Air Force Base with China's top foreign affairs official. But Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs David Stilwell said the Chinese were not really forthcoming. The meeting comes as relations between the world's two top economies have become
contentious
on a variety of issues. Little is known about the closed-door meetings. Joining us to talk more about what this all could mean is David Feierstein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Thank you for being with us. So this was a long way for both sides to travel, but we really know very little about what transpired. So what do you think this was all about?
I think that the United States and China both understand that the current trajectory in U.S.-China relations is bad for both countries. Whatever the merits of the U.S. positions relative to China and vice versa, the fact is there's been a downward spiral in the relationship that has been pretty dramatic over the last several months, in particular with COVID-19. And I think both sides understand that if we keep going down this path, neither the United States nor China are really going to benefit in a variety of different ways. And so I think my reading of this meeting, which I think is a significant interaction between the two top diplomats of the two countries respectively, is it's an opportunity to come together and kind of review the bidding on various issues, symbolically make it clear that each country still attaches importance to communicating, notwithstanding some pretty profound differences. And perhaps, you know, there was some discussion about what can be done to get this relationship moving in a somewhat more stable direction and to kind of stop the hemorrhaging, if you will. I don't know that a lot of progress was made, but I think sometimes just the process of coming together can be positive, or at least relatively positive. And I think that's probably the real significance of this meeting thus far.
This meeting comes at the same time that revelations came from the president's former national security advisor's book that's coming out that were pretty damning, including allegations that he was urging China to help him win re-election and supporting China's efforts to build concentration camps for Muslim Uyghurs. Should we just take that as this is another tell-all book and we really don't have anything to go on here? How do we process something like this?
I think it's pretty hard to dismiss outright the observations of the former national security advisor to the president, someone who was with the president in all of these key meetings during Mr. Bolton's tenure in the White House. I think it's hard to dismiss the observations of arguably the single most conservative foreign policy thinker in the country coming out and saying these kinds of things. It would be one thing if someone on the other side of the partisan aisle made these kinds of allegations. They would be dismissed as entirely political and part of campaign 2020 and so on. But when the most conservative or one of the most conservative political foreign policy thinkers in the country makes these statements about the president that he served and that he joined in the relevant meetings, to me, it's hard to dismiss that as just, you know, another tell-all story or another disgruntled employee, one of many who have left the White House on, you know, terms that were not ideal from the standpoint of either the president or the departing official. And to me, I think there a lot of what Mr. Bolton lays out in his book and in the comments that he's made about the book and the pre-publication stage ring true to many of the things that all of us have seen with our own eyes. It doesn't take Mr. Bolton to remind us that President Trump has spoken fawningly about President Xi Jinping and about the Chinese leadership, that he has been very mute on human rights issues in China on any number of occasions where many others were speaking up, and that in fact President Trump and candidate Donald Trump prior to his becoming president was extremely laudatory of China in many different respects, and that's a matter of public record. So in a sense, to me, the Bolton revelation have a considerable degree of credibility for a number of reasons, but not least because they completely track with what is already known and undisputed in the public record, along with the fact that no one can say that Bolton is a liberal or Democrat or someone that has a partisan axe to grind with the Republican president. So when you add those factors together, I think the comments that Mr. Bolton has made and the observations that he's shared are troubling. In many ways, they're alarming, but they are also, I think, very credible.
David Feierstein, president and CEO of the George H.W. Bush Foundation for U.S.-China Relations. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOA. U.S. federal safety investigators said Wednesday that the pilot of a helicopter that crashed in the foothills near Los Angeles, killing basketball great Kobe Bryant and seven others, likely became disoriented in the fog. The findings came in a so-called public docket released by the National Transportation Safety Board as it investigates the January crash. The NTSB has not yet released its official final report. In the last bastion of the rebellion against President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians who fled his rule see new U.S. sanctions as a step in the right direction, but say they must be shielded from any fallout as the currency crumbles. The toughest U.S. sanctions yet against Damascus came into effect on Wednesday under the CSAR Act, named after a Syrian photographer who smuggled thousands of photos out of Syria showing the mass killings, torture, and other crimes. The U.S. government has issued a warning about the threat posed by pirates to boats and oil installations in the southern Gulf of Mexico. It's the latest sign of concern about ongoing security challenges facing Mexico. In an updated travel advisory, the U.S. State Department said armed criminal groups have been known to target and rob commercial vessels, oil platforms, and offshore supply vessels in the Bay of Campeche area in the southern Gulf of Mexico. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Saturday is World Refugee Day, set aside to honor the struggles and courage of the tens of millions of people who've been forced to flee their homes in search of a safer place to live due to conflict or natural disaster. And while the number of refugees being allowed to come to the United States has been dramatically reduced under President Donald Trump, grassroots community volunteer groups have continued to offer refugees support they need to build a new life here. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke via Zoom with Kathy O'Callaghan, founder and president of Hearts and Homes for Refugees, a volunteer-driven humanitarian group in Westchester County, New York, that's been working with the U.S. State Department and others to welcome, assist, and advocate for refugees.
Well, it has to be emotional to start, but it's also very practical. We go through the whole rebuilding a life activities with a family from the time they arrive, finding housing, taking care of doctor's appointments and getting them enrolled in school, all of the things to help them resettle here to make it a little easier. But there's also work that we do that's shorter term. You know, we're not getting as many refugees in this country and we're not resettling as many. So volunteers match with families and individuals who are already here but face bumps in the road. So whether it's a mentoring or backpacks for kids or clothing or school supplies, anything that a family needs from time to time.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from refugees? They must be thrilled.
I think people are very grateful. Some of these relationships are very contractual. Thank you very much for the 3 months of support. We've had an interesting one where a young woman, we helped her just with initial needs and ended up helping her get ready for college. She wants to be a doctor and she wants to be a woman's doctor. She's from Central African Republic and she was a victim of female genital mutilation.
I imagine that most, if not all, refugees have been somewhat traumatized along the way.
You're right. So we go through a lot of training. We manage our expectations as volunteers without overpromising. But the volunteers understand that we have so much in common with refugees, and the thing that separates us is our circumstances. It's easy to work with someone or to help someone or to be a volunteer when what you see is a mother and a father, someone trying to do what any of us would want, to take care of our family, and we'd want to live in safety and we'd want to thrive. And that's what we can relate to as volunteers.
What generally motivates people to volunteer with you in the first place?
For many people, it's a moral imperative. For some people, it's what their faith calls them to do, or their values as Americans, they're people of goodwill.
Sounds like in their own way, volunteers get almost as much from this program as the refugees do.
Yeah, it's so true. I've had more volunteers say to me, this has been the most meaningful work. The local response to a global crisis can change the world. That's what powers Hearts and Homes for Refugees.
The larger community benefits from this too.
Everyone is enriched when others come into the community and bring their culture and their work.
Can you give me an example? I know you have these picnics where former and present refugees and volunteers and alumni all come and have some fun together.
Oh, I can give you an example. One of the families is from the Gambia, a wonderful family, and they were an asylum-seeking family and have stayed in touch. They are amazing cooks, and they were so excited to come to Westchester from the Bronx, and they came completely dressed in their beautiful, colorful clothing from their country, and they brought food, and they were the hit. They talked about their food, and they were did little dancing, and they talked about their color clothing. And for us, it's so unusual, but for them, that's the way they dress. They're used to that kind of beauty.
And did you serve them good old American hot dogs?
We actually had pizza. It's amazing how American ways become very quickly adopted by newcomers and our new neighbors.
So what are your thoughts for World Refugee Day 2020?
Given the conditions, we have the lowest number of refugees being admitted to this country in the history of the program. And contributing to that is growing racist and xenophobic and nationalistic attitudes. And piled onto that is a pandemic. They are suffering as victims again. So it's time we stand up and make our voices heard even louder.
VOA's Adam Phillips speaking with Kathy O'Callaghan, founder and president of Hearts and Homes for Refugees. And finally today, singer Jason Mraz has a new album coming out today on this Juneteenth, a celebration of the end of slavery in the United States. The two-time Grammy winner has promised to donate all the earnings from his reggae album, Looking for the Good, to groups working for racial equality and justice. Black Lives Matter and a number of other groups will be receiving donations, which Mraz is vowing to do annually on Juneteenth. To win some more. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.